From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in Washington, D.C. with President Joe Biden. A few days before his inauguration, Biden laid out his American Rescue Plan, a $1.9 trillion relief package that, if passed, would increase the minimum wage and unemployment benefits, finance a national vaccination program, and, unlike previous pandemic relief packages, place a focus on people with disabilities. President Biden's plan would end the sub-minimum wage for people with disabilities. That's a decades-old option, allowing employers to pay workers with disabilities less than the minimum wage. In some states, workers with disabilities are paid as little as $2.13 an hour. Biden's plan would also provide stimulus payments for adults with disabilities who are considered dependents. Those individuals were excluded from previous stimulus packages. This hour, we discuss those aspects of the plan with our guests. They'll weigh in on the impact of the proposals and what they may have, what the plan may be missing as well. We're also going to discuss their to-do list for a Biden-Harris administration when it comes to disability rights and laws. Our guests include Aaron Beyer, Executive Director of Access to Independence of Cortland County and Vice Chair of the New York State Independent Living Council. Aaron, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Great, Evan. Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Charles White is with us, a community patient representative in the Department of Neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And Nicole Jorwick is Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC. Nicole, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
This conversation is part of Dialogue on Disability Week, a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies in conjunction with the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series. Nicole, let me start with you. Just sort of a broad overview of what we're seeing from the Biden-Harris administration so far and what's sort of been proposed here. What jumps to mind first for you?
Yeah, I mean, so we were obviously very glad to see, as you said in your lead-in, that adult dependents were included in this proposal. It's been very frustrating that Congress keeps leaving adult dependents who are often older adults and people with disabilities and are at very high risk from COVID, so have serious work limitations right now, out, including most recently in December. It's really important support for individuals and families. Many have obviously lost a source or multiple sources of care or money and income and are providing a lot more care themselves. We are also have been really glad that the equity language specifically calls out disability, ensuring that disparate impact on people with disabilities will no longer be overlooked. People being served in all settings have really not been, unfortunately, the data collection hasn't been there. So we were glad to see that. And the ARC is supportive of the elimination of the phase out of the 14C certificate, which is the part of the Fair Labor Standards Act that allows for that subminimum wage that you mentioned. But we were surprised to see this included without additional funding to support people who would be impacted by that shift. Funding really needs to be included to build the infrastructure and supports needed to increase opportunities for competitive integrated employment. And also we need to see additional funding to raise the wages for the workforce, the direct care workforce. In addition, we obviously support raising the minimum wage and support for people with disabilities, but we also really need to make sure that we're including the workforce that supports people with disabilities because those wages are tied to Medicaid rates. And without including specific language and funding for wages of direct care workers providing services funded by Medicaid, it will exacerbate the workforce crisis. So this is a really good start, and there's a lot of really good pieces, but there's also plenty of things that we would like to see added in, and I'm sure I'll be happy to talk about that later.
Well,
but it's a really good start.
If I could, let me just make sure I understand the concern before we ask Charles and Aaron for their thoughts on what we're seeing. When it comes to the subminimum wage, I think a lot of people, myself included, who have been ignorant about the subminimum wage, when you first hear about it, it's sort of shocking. And then, you know, you hear some employers, I've read interviews where they've said, look, we want to support workers with disabilities. We cannot afford to pay workers with disabilities a full minimum wage. We feel like this is a way to get people in the door to be stimulated, to be compensated. But if we had to pay the minimum wage, we couldn't pay them. Is that part of what your concern is when you talk about how to support integrated workforces? If this administration does away with the subminimum wage but doesn't have additional support in place, Is your concern that some employers will say, well, fine, we're not going to employ workers with disabilities? Or can you walk me through what the concern is there?
Sure. So many services that support people with disabilities to work are also funded through the Medicaid program. So things like job coaching and other supports on the job are funded through a system that has been stressed and strapped by the COVID pandemic and frankly already was before that. And so you have to have those supports in place. So no, I'm not worried. I mean, the data bears out that employing people with disabilities is good for businesses' bottom line. So I never have a problem telling businesses that they need to step up to the plate and be paying people with disabilities a minimum wage. It's more that we need to make sure that we're not adding additional stress onto a system without additional federal funding to support it, because we need to have those wraparound supports for individuals who right now might have a place to go for 40 hours a week, even if they're not doing something that they want to be doing. We need to be able to build those opportunities for what's called competitive integrated employment. And so that includes funding for Medicaid so that we have those job coaching supports, those job developers to go find the jobs, et cetera.
Okay. Those are some of the examples you mean by wraparound supports?
Yes. And also community-based programming, because it might not be that everybody wants to work 40 hours a week, but we need to make sure that we have people with disabilities who have person-centered plans and have things to do with their days in the community.
And I don't mean to be cynical, Nicole. I certainly think there are many people who get involved with politics who really want to solve problems, really want to address issues. Cynically, I fight this urge to think, well, sometimes an administration will try to do something that is a gesture without solving a problem more holistically. Do you get the sense that this administration cares deeply about these issues, will learn, and will follow through? Or do you get the sense that they're saying, hey, you know, we're giving you something, don't complain?
Well, I have been very lucky to have some really good conversations with high-level members of the Biden administration, and I do not think that this is just a pander point mm-hmm. to your
sure.
question, but I do think that there are room for improvement, and I have certainly not been quiet with those folks. The ARC is a nonpartisan organization, but we need to make sure that we're in the room and talking about that. And there are some specific things that we've been fighting for over almost a year now at this point with COVID that were not included that would address some of these things. And so I don't think that it is, I do think it's something that they didn't probably fully understand what was missing from the full scope of the proposal. And so we will work hard to make sure that we're the subject matter experts that they can rely on to make it a better policy.
Charles White, what have you seen so far from the new administration, and what stands out to you?
Well, one thing that stands out to me is that some of the racial injustice and the systematic struggles that most Black and Brown communities face are being addressed to some level. And as far as subminimum wages, that's only a part of the discrimination that people with disabilities and people of color and face in the workplace. And it's inconsistent with the civil rights protection, which people with disabilities are entitled to, whether it's through unfair pay or a failure to get proper accommodations. I think it's long overdue.
Okay. And so if you're in the room advising now with policymakers, what can be done, you know, in short order that hasn't yet been done or done in recent years?
Well, I believe in short order. First of all, we need to, I think the Biden administration needs to sign and come up with legislations concerning racial issues and addressing housing for people of color and with disabilities, and also addressing the social economic inequities between privileged and marginalized communities.
All right. Aaron Beyer, what stands out to you first with the new administration, with what they're working on?
Well, Evan, we're really hopeful. From day one of the administration, we've seen a strong effort to promote accessibility from the inauguration on. With this plan, the elimination of subminimum wage is a long overdue and long awaited move. the stimulus payments for adult dependents is a much needed stimulus. People with disabilities want to work, and that's kind of the bottom line. People with disabilities across the nation have been advocating for equal pay, equal employment opportunities. And when what they've been lacking is training. As Nicole pointed out, the job coaching, the job developers, where funding needs to be allocated now is in state relief, so that training programs through state-funded vocational rehabilitation, in New York State Office of Persons with Developmental Disabilities, Office of Mental Health, all have vocational training programs. So not only does funding need to be there to support paying people with disabilities the minimum wage, but they need to have the opportunities for proper job training through state programs, and so that they can maintain the employment that they want to keep without feeling fear of discrimination because they're not receiving the appropriate accommodations or because an employer believes that they're not worth the money they're being paid.
You know, when you mention, Aaron, the movement toward more inclusivity, starting with the inauguration, there are certain things that I think I guess sometimes I'm surprised at my own ignorance. I would have assumed, for example, that there are interpreters for daily press briefings at the White House. There have not been. NPR reported just yesterday that the White House announced yesterday that its regular press briefings will now include an American Sign Language interpreter. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that the move was part of this administration's accessibility and inclusion efforts. And again, Aaron, I think I just thought, why have there not been interpreters for a long time there? And, you know, it, to me, it was a reminder to that, you know, if we're not, you know, sort of careful, we get stuck in our own silos, and you can miss all of the lack of inclusivity that is out there. So is that announcement, am I making too much of that announcement at the White House, or is that a small but sort of a small thing, big thing that indicates the administration actually cares?
I think it's not small, and I think it's a major change in tone. Earlier in the year, disability groups in New York State had to sue the governor's office because Governor Cuomo failed to have sign language interpreters at his daily COVID briefings. So this move, not only sign language interpreters, but if you were to look back at the inauguration of President Biden and Vice President Harris, there were also audio description versions of that inauguration for people who are blind or lack the vision acuity to see what was happening on screen during the inauguration. So all of these steps to improve the inclusiveness of those events, of those press briefings, are super critical to lowering the disparities faced by people with disabilities of all types.
Okay. And as Nicole mentioned, that, you know, she's had conversations with people in the administration. She does feel like these issues are being taken seriously, that it's not just sort of lip service. Charles, do you feel this administration is serious about, as you said, racial equity, disability discrimination? Do you feel that so far from what you've seen, this is a serious administration?
Yes, I do. I honestly believe that this administration directly wants to smear on these systematic injustices that are faced throughout our society, especially because of what happened November the 6th with the rise of the Capitol. We understand that there are forces and systems out there to discriminate, and things have to change as far as legislation and as far as the ability to reach our communities in a way where it won't be discriminatory. So I do believe that this administration is very serious about confronting and spearheading these issues.
But can I ask you, and I'm going to start with Nicole on this one, because you mentioned, you know, that the arc is nonpartisan. When we look at a $1.9 trillion relief package from this administration, when we look at debates about funding for different programs, historically, there has been a push-pull between the major political parties, with Democrats generally in favor of more funding for such initiatives, Republicans not so much. And I don't mean to sort of paint an ungenerous picture, because certainly, you know, both parties have spent plenty of money when they've had the levers of power. But in this case, is it truly, is it tenable for the ARC to be nonpartisan? I mean, is it, has it been difficult to stay nonpartisan, particularly when you look at the last year, you look at the different efforts on whether it's coronavirus stimulus, where the emphasis and priorities are and where the emphasis and priorities have not been? Has it been difficult to remain nonpartisan, or do you, you know, do you sort of see the parties as somewhat similar on these issues?
Sure. So a complex question, but what I would say is that I work very hard, and all members of the policy team at the ARC work very hard to maintain our relationships on both sides of the aisle. What I would say is that it's not even just this past year. You also look at 2017, when they were proposing, when the Republicans had the presidency in both houses of Congress, and they were proposing overturning the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA, or Obamacare, and paying for it by gutting Medicaid. And Medicaid is the only game in town when it comes to funding home and community-based services that keep people with disabilities and aging adults in their communities and in their homes. And I went to hundreds of Hill meetings in 2017 and on both sides of the aisle, and I would hear from both sides of the aisle how much they support home and community-based services. And then I would remind them that the $1 trillion cut would come directly to those services because they're not mandatory under the law. And that was a frustration that I still haven't quite processed. So that is difficult for me to face. But what we continue to do there are is not to get bogged down or caught up in the cost savings argument. What we're talking about is modernizing a system that was originally meant to serve people with disabilities and aging adults. And it is going to take an investment, but it's an investment in the care infrastructure that we can't afford not to take. And that's really how we kind of try to stay above the fray. We're talking about doing the right thing, and that's going to take educating Congress. It's also going to take educating the general public, but that's kind of how we try to stay above the fray.
Hmm. Aaron Beyer, are you in sort of a similar mindset that a lot of this is about educating policymakers, certainly at the federal level, but at all levels of government, and that you've got faith that you can do it?
Absolutely. We've worked, as Nicola said, you know, we've worked in the independent living world. We've worked with both sides of the aisle to educate lawmakers and regulators about the needs of people with disabilities, about where those disparities are, and about where we see the most bang for buck happening with funding. It is an investment in our future and the future of our kids and people with disabilities, and we need to make sure that people have the opportunities, have the equity and opportunity that are enjoyed by everyone else without disabilities. And that goes for the intersections of race, as Charles has talked about, people living in poverty, people in the LGBT community. All of these intersect with disability and add up to a great deal of inequity. Nicole also mentioned the home and community-based services. In the Biden plan currently, there are protections for people living in congregate settings. These are, you know, state-run facilities through OPWDD and also nursing facilities. There is no current protections for people living with home and community-based services, and this is a place where I think the plan could be strengthened, more money could be invested, so that people living at home who don't currently have access to testing or to vaccination or appropriate home care and aid services, there needs to be more protections in place for those individuals.
Hmm. We're going to talk in a moment about Medicaid and really the path forward with Medicaid in this administration and how it impacts the disability community and the various services that are represented in conversations on the show. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. Charles, are you sort of similarly able to view this in a nonpartisan lens? Has that become harder over the years?
No, it hasn't. And I do view it with a nonpartisan lens. And I want to just piggyback on what Evan said. Myself, I've been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I'm currently in a wheelchair. And since the pandemic has come, I've noticed more isolation for myself, and my aid services has been discontinued. So for someone like myself, being impacted with a disability and the effects of COVID-19 on social issues, I piggyback on what Evan said, that there needs to be more protection around your core strength of serving people with disabilities. Because I know for myself, I'm single and I don't have an aid service, nor do I have anyone to assist me through these times. And it's hard to find that those services. And I know that they're available, but because of the racial issues and access for people of color with disabilities, I'm impacted even more.
And Charles, Marielle sends us a note saying, Cuomo keeps saying the state has no money. How is New York State going to be able to continue to offer some of these services? I think there's probably some confusion about who funds what and, you know, what the Biden administration is hoping to do. Because I know the governor's talked a lot in recent weeks about the importance of a new administration and a new Congress stepping up to help states and in essence, then localities fund their budgets without massive cuts, et cetera. But, Charles, when you talk about helping people, particularly people of color, find the services they need, how much is that sort of threatened right now in the pandemic environment? Or are you sort of confident that the Biden administration is addressing that?
Well, I'm confident that the Biden administration will address it, but what I think needs more federal money provided to the states to have these services available on all levels. And I think people with disabilities need to be represented in those conversations.
Aaron, when it comes to that question from Mariel on the state level, she says, Cuomo keeps saying the state is out of money. How concerned are you about sort of the state-level budget crunch and what Washington's going to be able to do to make sure that services are not cut?
Definitely. The state is in a difficult place right now. Nonprofits, municipalities, local governments are seeing currently a 20% withhold in state funding. That is to help address the current budget deficit that New York State is facing. What we are hoping and what is really we're optimistic about this Biden plan is that there is a great deal of relief funding for states, which will trickle down and help eliminate those withholds. So New York State, if this plan goes through, if relief comes to the states, Cuomo has already said in his executive budget that those withholds will be restored, that monies will be reimbursed. And going forward, we may not have to have those withholds as long as the federal aid is there to support it. So that's kind of the trickle-down effect that such a federal plan could have.
Nicole, can you add to that?
Yes, and I can, and I agree with, obviously, the sentiments of both panelists. And I think that what we really need to see, because as was just said, some of the states funding might trickle down, but we can't rely on that. We have seen with the CARES Act that passed in March of last year that there was some pretty substantial state aid at that point. And outside of a handful of states, no state put directly that money into the Medicaid, home and community-based services that we've been talking about. There is a bill that was introduced in December and that we know will be introduced this week, called the Coronavirus HCBS, and that's Home and Community-Based Services Relief Act. It was introduced by Senator Casey and Representative Dingell, and that bill would specifically give funding to states to provide these services. It would certainly help get those holds off of the New York budget. But in addition, it's really a drop in the bucket. It's a $13 billion bill that would include dedicated funding to support the provision of home and community-based services that Charles was talking about, why that's so important to him personally. I also am a family member. My brother Chris wouldn't be able to get out at all if he didn't have his workers who are paid for by Medicaid. So that's in the short term what needs to be included in the package.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand what's in and what's out then before we go to break here, because reading from Forbes, I'll quote from Forbes now, again, kind of putting an emphasis on the point Nicole's raising here from Forbes. Quote, "The most disappointing omission from the American Relief Plan is the lack of support for home and community-based services. HCBS, for short, is a category of services that combined make up the main alternative to nursing homes, group homes, and other congregate care for people who need help with everyday tasks and care. It can include any combination of medical, semi-medical, and simple non-medical assistance provided to people with disabilities in their own homes or apartments, paid for by government funds, designed to keep them safe, healthy, and independent." So, again, I don't know how fast things are changing, Nicole, but there's can you just kind of reemphasize the point here, what's in and what's out right now, or I guess what's still up in the air?
Yes. I would definitely categorize it as what's still up in the air, because we obviously haven't seen any legislative text. There has not been a bill draft written. We're reacting to President Biden's proposal, and obviously we're already working with the administration as well as Congress to make sure that this is not left out. But specifically, what is not included right now, and that has not been included in any bill that has passed Congress since COVID-19 came to us all, unfortunately, is dedicated funding for Medicaid home and community-based services, which is at extreme risk because they are considered optional. And as state budgets are going to be stressed and stretched, we need to see that dedicated federal funding to support those services to keep people with disabilities in their communities and not in these dangerous congregate settings.
What does that lobbying sort of look like? I mean, you know, by now you would assume members of Congress and the administration understand what's at stake here. Is it, do you feel like you're sort of in the middle of a political game?
Absolutely. I think that what I said over and over to our chapter network all over the country is that last year we felt like we were stuck in big P politics, because, I mean, I have conversations daily with health staff on both sides of the aisle. They understand the issue. It was the top priority, not only for the disability community, but also for the aging community, to get this to support people with disabilities and aging adults. And yet, in every single package, it was not included. I do need to point out that it was included in the Democratic proposals, the HEROES Act and HEROES 2.0, but it was never included in anything that was seriously under consideration. And the fact we are very happy, and as I said, I don't think it's lip service, but I was very disappointed to not see this specific funding called out in the Biden proposal, because I do know that they understand that this is necessary, but it needs to be specifically called out, because disability, if you make things work for people with disabilities, it works better for everyone.
Nicole, maybe I watched like too much Veep or something, but like I'm envisioning you calling Chuck Schumer's office and him going, "Oh, I really thought that the Biden administration was going to do this. I'm really sorry." And you know, you just sort of unloading on the majority leader or I mean, like, is that what's actually happening here? Is this a case of you feeling like until it's in legislation, you don't trust it's going to happen?
Yes, and I'm laughing because the last in-person Hill meeting that I went to was with Senator Schumer, was one of the senators that was there. And it was on March 11th of 2020, and this was the issue that I raised. And I remind them every time I talk to them that I've been raising it ever since then, and it keeps getting left out. And every sort of it's like screaming into a void half the time. I've walked out of meetings. I don't have that luxury on Zoom anymore. In 2017, I used to be able to walk out. We are, you know, screaming and yelling, and we know we'd have almost 200,000 actions to Congress specifically on this HCBS issue. And so that's what I remind them to.
Yeah. And so before our only break, I want to ask all three of you then, based on what we're hearing from Nicole Jorwick here, who is the Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC, as Congress, the Biden administration, consider new relief plans that will or will not include a wide range of funding that could impact people in the disability community across this country. Nicole, if you are disappointed again, I don't like to do this, but give me the worst case scenario. I mean, what are you most concerned about, and what are the sort of the effects of it?
Well, I mean, the worst case scenario comes with a body count. Not to be dramatic, but that's what we've seen. And the data has borne out that the death and infection rates for people with disabilities, particularly people with IDD, intellectual and developmental disabilities, is clear everywhere. And we also had a study come out of California that showed the bigger the setting, the worse the death and infection rate is. And so if we don't have dedicated funding for home and community-based services, because the program is optional under the federal Medicaid law, states will have no choice but to continue to cut those services that Charles mentioned. And what that will mean is that the only thing that will be left are those dangerous congregate settings. There are still institutions open in 36 states that are, quote unquote, serving people with disabilities. There's a lot of people with disabilities in nursing homes. We know how dangerous those are. Without a change, it's going to cost people's lives, and it's also going to cost the service system that people with disabilities have been fighting to build since the 80s when HCBS waivers were created.
Please do, Charles. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to comment on what Nicole was saying.
Yeah.
I fear for my future. I'm a 55-year-old black man with disabilities. I've worked all my life, and I've worked good-paying jobs all my life. So for me to be in a position now where I'm facing, now I need help, you know, I'm 55, you know, what's going to happen in the next 10 years with my condition? Who's going to be around me? What kind of services are going to be available for someone like me? So it's very, very important that we establish, and I say we, I mean people with disabilities in the community, establish these dedicated funds for these community-based programs so that people like myself can have a successful future. Because right now, my future looks bleak because I don't have a dedicated AIDS service, nor is it funded through Medicare. But where are the systems that's in place to provide so that these AIDS service companies can actually have quality people to assist? So it's very important for me that these legislations and these policies be addressed, like first and forehand. And if I can be of any assistance, I'm willing to go the extra mile to help promote and bring awareness to people in marginalized communities that face disabilities.
Well, I appreciate that perspective, Charles. And Aaron Beyer, Executive Director of Access to Independence of Cortland County and Vice Chair of the New York State Independent Living Council. You know, you hear Charles say he's concerned that his future is bleak. And, you know, Nicole Jorwick is being very direct about the fact that, you know, the worst case scenario comes with a body count. Again, not meant to be clickbaity. I mean, it's just meant to be real here. What is the worst case scenario as you see it as the federal government decides what to do next year?
Well, without home and community-based services, that leaves people with one option, and that's congregate care nursing facilities, which are some of the most expensive care facilities in our state and in the country. Home and community-based services overall have saved money, Medicaid dollars, through their implementation. Nicole's spot on. Without this funding, without home and community-based services, we need to be careful of that body count. People with disabilities will die. And we can't – this is what terrifies me and so many people with disabilities. We cannot allow ourselves to be failed by the system that has for too long not adequately had our representation in it.
Yes.
That feeling of hopelessness cannot go on. We need to make sure that these services are available. So in my opinion, we cannot allow our government to say that home and community-based services are going away. They need to be there. They need to be funded through Medicaid, through whatever means possible. They cannot go away. They need to be a viable and equitable option for all people, including those with disabilities.
Well, this conversation is part of Dialogue on Disability Week here at WXXI. It's a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies in conjunction with the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series. You just heard Aaron Beyer, Executive Director of Access to Independence of Cortland County, Inc., and Vice Chair of the New York State Independent Living Council. Charles White is a community patient representative in the Department of Neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Nicole Jorwick is Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC. And we are taking a look at what the Biden administration has proposed and what Congress is still considering when it comes to what programs, what initiatives to fund, and how to deal with not just the pandemic, but with Medicaid, with access to services, and with all kinds of implications here. Let's take this only break and we'll come back to more of your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, if you wanted to move anytime soon, for example, if you were thinking about buying a house, are there any limitations you would face? People with disabilities face limitations all the time. The housing stock is really substandard for people with disabilities, and we're going to talk on Wednesday about how that might change. And that's not just up to people with disabilities. It's part of our Dialogue on Disability, and we'll talk with you Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew writes to say one of the reasons that Congress should get on this issue is just look at New York State with nursing homes and what's happened in nursing homes during the pandemic. Independent living matters. Well, Nicole Jorwick, is that oversimplifying to you, how do you sort of draw lessons from what has happened in long-term care, nursing home, those kind of facilities during this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think frankly what we have seen are the things that disability rights advocates have been talking about for a really long time, which is the fact that when you have large congregate settings, they are public health problems. And that's unfortunately what we've seen. I know in Illinois, the state that I'm from, the National Guard was called in because two institutions had over that are still open there, because there are seven still open there, had over half of the residents and staff test positive for COVID. And so as we've seen it, I mean, lessons we've learned, first of all, is that unfortunately the last administration did not pay attention to any long-term care facility that was not a nursing home. They were not doing the same sort of data and tracking requirements in institutions, for example, like they were in nursing homes. But what the lesson that we learned is that we need to handle this, the institutional bias in the Medicaid program once and for all. This is something that the ARC has been advocating around since home and community-based service waivers were created by President Reagan in the 1980s. And right now, those long-term care and nursing homes are mandatory under the Medicaid program that we were just talking about. And those home and community-based service life-giving services are optional. That's why there are almost a million people on waiting lists all over the country for those services. And that's only the people who know that there are waiting lists to be on, which is a whole other issue. But we need Congress and we need President Biden to shepherd a modernization of the Medicaid program, because what we have seen in COVID has been exactly what we've all been yelling about for decades.
Charles, you want to add to that? I heard you jumping in there.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but what you were saying, Nicole, is spot on. Like, I concur with everything you just said.
And let me also kick this over to Aaron. I want to read from what the ACLU has put on their to-do list for the Biden and Harris administration when it comes to disability rights. The ACLU wants to ensure that people with disabilities can live in their communities, not in institutions, and support the direct care workforce. The administration must implement a national strategy to expand access to Medicaid's home and community-based services. Again, that's HCBS. And So I want to talk a little bit about that with you, Aaron, and maybe in context with what Andrew emailed regarding what we've seen in nursing homes. Now, he's connecting what we've seen in nursing homes to a desire to see more people have the option to live at home, to age at home, to live in their communities. Is that a fair connection? I mean, do you think that the pandemic has revealed problems in nursing homes, problems in policy, et cetera?
I think the pandemic has revealed problems in any congregate care settings. We've seen deaths in nursing facilities. We've seen deaths in IDDD group homes across the state and across the country. These were supposed to be places of safety for people, and they've become places of fear and health concerns. In 1990, the Olmstead decision the Supreme Court passed said that people with disabilities have the right to choose to live in the community and not in nursing facilities. HCBS is a way to reach that. But as long as they are optional services and not truly afforded to anyone who seeks them, it sets a dangerous precedent.
When I'm looking at the ACLU here, you know, it's still talking about it's that language that was sort of jarring to me, Aaron. People with disabilities should be able to live in their communities, not in institutions. And again, this is where I should own my own ignorance. I mean, I'm this hopeful person who thinks, well, you know, we used to institutionalize as a default, but that was decades ago. Does that language jump out to you from the ACLU? I mean, what should we know about that?
People with disabilities have, in New York State, deinstitutionalization has definitely happened. However, nursing facilities and some congregate care settings are considered institutionalized settings because they are government run. Across the country, there are still instances where institutions, as we used to see in the 60s, still exist. ACLU, as a nationwide administration, needs to make sure that these types of settings go away. They need to make sure that people with disabilities have the freedom to live in their community on their own with the appropriate services that they themselves need. Each person is unique. Each person may need aid service. They might need at-home nursing. The level of aid services they need varies. Now we have to make sure that those people also have access to testing and vaccinations so that they can get in and out of their homes and be part of their community. It's one thing to live in the community. It's another thing to be part of the community and have the freedom to participate in all aspects of that community.
Yeah, and let me ask Nicole and Charles a little bit more about the ACLU's platform there. Nicole, can you add to that about institutionalization? For some reason, that word jumped off the page at me, and that's probably just a further sign of my ignorance on this.
Well, I don't think that it's ignorance, but I do think it's when I talked about the general public understanding that we need to build, it's, you know, obviously you're someone who has your toe in this issue, and it's still not necessarily something that people realize. And there are still 36 states that have people with disabilities in institutions. And those are called institutions. They're sometimes called state schools. They're sometimes called state-operated developmental centers. That's part of why I don't think people think of them as that term, but that's what they are. They're called a lot of different things, but ultimately what they are places where people with disabilities are segregated away from the community, and they're not being integrated, and they do not have person-centered supports, which is what Medicaid should be funding. We also know that there's a cost component there, but obviously making home and community-based services mandatory, which is going to be the main goal and my driving force, is going to be expensive because you're serving people that aren't currently being served. But there is also a cost saving. Right now, I have some national data that I happen to have memorized that the average cost for serving a person in an institution is $294,300 per year. To serve individuals with home and community-based services, the average nationally per participant annually is $49,854. So we have almost $300,000 to serve a person in an institution, and that's because of a variety of issues, including building costs, et cetera, versus $50,000. Now, some people are going to be more expensive because they need more, and that's okay. You know, we need to make sure that all the funding is there. But not only is it antiquated and outdated, it's also a lot more expensive. And this is why we need to just overhaul the system.
God, wow. And, you know, Charles, I just want to ask you about one other plank that the ACLU has. They're concerned about criminalizing people who, for a number of reasons, through the healthcare system. Let me read a little bit from there. They say that we need to stop law enforcement's disproportionate targeting of people with mental health disabilities and the entrapment of people with disabilities in the criminal legal system, and ensure that everyone has access to information they need to make sure that they can find the adequate care they need. They go on to say, when people don't have information about the services they can get, and they're desperate, they don't have money, often they find themselves in very hard times and sometimes in very hard circumstances. And the ACLU says, number one, you've got to fund programs. Number two, you've got to make sure people get the communication and the knowledge on how to access services in all communities. Can you just talk a little bit about that, Charles?
Yes, just like in Daniel Prude's case. Here's a guy looking for mental health, and the police were called. I think funding should be directed away from having police respond to mental health issues and create some type of government where mental health professionals actually respond to these issues.
It does sound like Rochester, the city of Rochester, is moving in that direction, and Mayor Warren announced a rollout of at least a new way of responding to some calls that would replace armed police officers with mental health responders. There's been proposals in a lot of communities across the country about that, and that's certainly something as we go throughout 2021 to follow. Let me also read an email from Rochelle, who says, I have a child that has just been diagnosed with autism. Until now, my child has been denied services his whole life just because my child lacked a proper autism diagnosis, even though I had years of evidence. We were told it was more mental health versus developmental health, and that limited services offered to people like us who needed them. Many people and many more will be falling through the cracks. I meet many other families that have had this experience. Is this discrimination? That's from Rochelle. Nicole, does that sound like discrimination to you?
I think it is discrimination, and it's also, again, another example of a system that it doesn't know how to assess the needs of all people with all different types of support needs. And that's an issue not only when it comes to Medicaid, home and community-based services, it's also an issue when it comes to vocational rehabilitation supports and other supports. And in addition, when we're talking about modernizing the Medicaid program to make sure that we're making home and community-based services mandatory, we also need to make sure that when we're talking about eligibility, which is what Rochelle is getting to in her question, we need to make sure that we are not letting people fall through the cracks, that individuals with less support needs but still who do need support are not left with no answers and nowhere to go.
Well, in about a minute, Nicole, what do you want to leave listeners with as we think about what this new administration, what Congress is doing, and what the next priorities are? What should be top of mind for people?
I think the thing that should be top of mind for everyone is that all of the disability community is the only group that any of us could join at any moment, and that the long-term services and support system, which is the broad system that funds home and community-based services, as well as the other dangerous settings that we've been talking about, nursing homes, et cetera, needs to be fixed, and that and Medicaid is really the only game in town. And so people need to understand that if they think that the supports that they need for home care when they get older or other things are going to be covered, that it's not. And unless we make this major investment that will benefit all of us eventually, because we will all age or we all could be a person with a disability or have a family member who is, we really have to address this issue. Nobody should be in a situation where they're waiting for services, where they're isolated, where they don't have access to what they need to be integrated in the community. The term integration means to be made whole. And in order to make the country whole as we recover from the COVID pandemic, We need to make sure that there's funding for Medicaid to make sure that everybody can be integrated into their homes and into their communities, and we'll all be a better country for it.
All right. Aaron Beyer, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I think that the Biden administration has put us off to a good start, and it's given us a lot of hope. I think we need to make sure, as a community of people with disabilities, our families and our allies, that the administration and our state governments understand the importance of home and community-based services, of Medicaid, of paying fair wages, and just making sure that people with disabilities not only have a place in our communities, but an equal place in our communities.
All right. Charles White, 30 seconds. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I believe that the Biden administration is on track to really taking care of the necessary things that are causing the biases and the racial injustices that prevent people with disabilities in the community to have access. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Charles, for being part of the conversation, a community patient representative at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Aaron Beyer, Executive Director of Access to Independence of Cortland County and Vice Chair of the New York State Independent Living Council. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Evan.
Nicole Jorwick is the Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC. Nicole, we're grateful for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
And this is part of our Dialogue on Disability Week. More conversations coming your way later this week. Until then, Rob Braden, Engineer of Connections, Megan Mack, Producer, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.